Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Poison Pen. This is a wonderful opportunity for a summer read conversation because Francine Matthews' new book, Tethet Tupperknuck, do I have that right? I can't pronounce it.
Death on Tuckernuck.
Thank you. Death on Tuckernuck, which I have to say is a place I never heard of. And then weirdly, not only did Francine write a whole book about it, but one of my own authors, Stephen Axelrod, also includes Tupperknuck in a forthcoming book about Nantucket. So how is it, Francine, that Tupperknuck has suddenly become prominent?
Oh, my goodness. Tupperknuck is one of those exceedingly well-kept secrets, even on Nantucket. If you are on the island and you mention that you're going over to Tuck, people will just stop, look at you with a slight edge of awe and say, how are you getting over there? I've always wanted to go. And the reason is because Tuckernuck is this tiny little, it's about 900 acres, island off the western coast of Nantucket Island. At one point, geologically, it was part of the island, but it's been separated by, you know, snow melt from glacial retraction. And it's about a mile and a half off the coast of Nantucket. It's completely privately owned by the families that have houses on the island. There is no public thoroughfare on the island. There's no electrical grid. There is no public water. There's not a single gas station. There's not a place to buy coffee. It's all private homes. And everything that you need to survive on the island has to be ferried across by people you hire to do so, because there is no ferry officially between Nantucket and Tuckernuck. So it's a very private, profoundly gated community, gated for 300 years by the people who chose to live there and who always, of course, had their own boats to travel between Nantucket and Tuckernuck in the 18th and 19th centuries. But now there's a whole cadre of people called caretakers who are hired seasonally to bring everything that a homeowner on Tuckernuck needs. There's about 40 houses out there, many of them inherited by families that have actually intermarried on Tuckernuck over the centuries. And so it's a fascinating community. It's intensely private. It's profoundly guarded by the people who love the place. And it is like pulling hen's teeth to actually get on the island if you don't live there yourself.
So in many ways, it's really sort of a warp in time kind of island where life goes on maybe as it did 50 or 60 or longer years ago on Nantucket.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, at one point in the 19th century and then in the early 20th century, families from Nantucket who found it too crowded, too touristy, too popular, were deliberately moving to Tuckernuck. And there was sort of an in-migration between Nantucket and Tuckernuck at that point. And there used to be a school on Tuckernuck. And so some kids were actually born there, went to school there, and then lived there. And that's a unique experience. Now it's an historic one because it's an entirely seasonal island. The water between Nantucket and Tuckernuck actually freezes in certain parts of the winter, January, and so you cannot access the island. And most of the houses are not winterized. And so people, the last weekend that you're kind of officially there, a caretaker told me, was Columbus weekend in October.
Right. Well, it would be a dangerous place to be if you had a medical incident, for example, when it's cut off.
Yeah.
All these remote communities are proving to be wonderful in many ways, but really difficult if you're aging or if you are suddenly ill.
Yeah. One of the fascinating things that hit me when I went over there for research purposes with a caretaker, and it took me a year to set that up. Working networks I have, finding people who actually live on the island and who could point me in the right direction. When I actually went over to Tuckernuck with the caretakers and talked to them, they were saying to me, you know, the actual landing lagoon, the town landing, if you will, on Tuckernuck is silting in, and the whole of that barrier island is surrounded by shoals of shifting sand that are impossible to chart. And if you, I have a chart of the waters and the shoals are shown with dotted lines because they change all the time. And so it's an extremely difficult landing to navigate. And one set of caretakers has their own landing stage that they maintain for that reason. And they said the week before that one of the residents had had a coronary incident and they were the EMT. They basically had to bring their boat in and get her to Nantucket Cottage Hospital because the Coast Guard can't land there. Their draft is too deep and you can't send an EMT boat over. So it was fascinating to me. Because there's no electrical power, they have to bring over solar panels for generators or propane tanks. You know, they bring over I-beams if someone's building an addition. They bring over, the week I was there, 150 guests for a wedding. All of the chairs, porta-johns, the caterer, the florists, and they had to get all the guests over as well for the wedding and then off the island when the wedding was done. Because of course there's nowhere for them to stay. So it's just fascinating how people negotiate living on that little barrier enclave. But when I was thinking about writing Death on Tuckernuck, what hit me was what an extraordinary location for a murder. How does Mary Folger as a Nantucket police detective respond when she learns there is a body on Tuckernuck and you can't get a Coast Guard boat in? And I multiplied that crisis factor by putting it on the cusp of a hurricane, which grounds a boat on the island. And when people respond to the grounding of the yacht, they discover that there are gunshot victims inside. So it was fascinating to me as a writer just to play with the locale and the constraints that life there dictates.
Well, in this sense, you're almost like Agatha Christie with a country manor in a blizzard. Almost all the way back to Treasure Island, you know. Yeah. But the truth is there's so few places anymore in the world that are truly isolated, but I can certainly see why it would inspire the crime writer. The other part that Francine hasn't mentioned, but which makes, I think, this so interesting, is that among all of these old residents and so forth on Tuckernuck, there is a celebrity who has created a very contemporary compound. And that adds to the complexity of what Mary has to deal with. Did you actually see one or did you just make that up?
Both. Tuckernuck is traditionally, as I mentioned, comprised of houses that are passed down through generations. The problem is, as families expand and disperse and inherit these properties, not everybody wants to maintain them. And so there can be crisis points on the island when a particular group of owners decides to sell. And what has occurred in the past is that there's sort of a homeowners association that attempts to buy the place and keep it within the control of the residents of the island. And they have a conservation trust and they will establish the properties that they buy as open space, as conservancy land. The problem with that is that sometimes families decide to sell outside of that sort of protective mechanism that the island has established. And so I stumbled across this interesting real estate ad in Boston Magazine for a property on Tuckernuck, and it was for the renovated life-saving station that used to be there, an historic building. They'd completely renovated it as this gorgeous studio apartment with a beautiful deck with barn doors that opened to the ocean views, and it just was drop-dead gorgeous. But the real point of this little studio apartment was it came with Historic Association approved plans, which is the Nantucket vehicle for maintaining historical standards in architecture, for a 7-bedroom home with caretaker cottage with a generator plant. And so, a whole parcel of 20 acres that you could build on. And the builder was already lined up. And so I looked at that and I thought, okay, this is a profound shift. This is somebody with a lot of money who is buying into a pre-made, pre-approved mansion compound that they can establish on Tucker Nook. This is utterly different from anything that you would normally see on this little island. And something got away from the residents in that parcel of land that was for sale in Boston Magazine. I mean, that, you know, with the full color spread of photographs, I thought, okay, this is a shift. Because once that happens, that's been happening all over Nantucket. The way of life on Tucker Nook will never be the same. It will become increasingly sort of like, oh, I'm forgetting the name. It was a Mustique. Mustique. You know, Princess Margaret and all the beautiful people of the 60s used to go to Mystique, and they owned it, and you couldn't land on it unless you owned it, and it was the most private and elitist spot on earth. So I see that as a huge tension in Tucker Nook's future, but it could become that. It could become a place that people buy for its profound privilege and isolation. Because they can fly in. You can establish a runway. There is one runway on Tucker Nook that local people who own prop planes will use. But you know, that doesn't stop anybody from landing a helicopter there or whatever and flying in and out. People already fly in and out to of Nantucket itself who have profound money, bringing their private chefs and their staff, and you know, it's one of their 7 houses that they are living in for 4 weeks at a time. And then they leave. And that's a phenomenon that has grown increasingly on Nantucket in the past 15 to 20 years, in a way that was very, very different from when I was a kid going there in the summers. So, what fascinates me about the community as a place for setting murder, Barbara, is there's this inherent tension between those who live on the island and make it function. The police, the teachers, the doctors and nurses and EMTs at Nantucket Cottage Hospital, anyone who owns a business, the booksellers, the artists who paint and photograph and throw pots, anyone who makes the community a living, vibrant place believes they own the island, particularly if they live there year round. And then there are those who fly in with profound fortunes that sustain the economy, enjoy the incredible beauty of the place and its history, contribute to it by maintaining the homes, absolutely have a stake in the place, but also think that they own Nantucket. And often their aims are in conflict. And when you have conflict in a community, you have immense possibility for violence. So to me, it's a fascinating milieu for a detective novel series because normal situations of ordinary life can devolve quickly into something else, at least in my head.
No, I actually, Scottsdale has been through a version of that. Santa Fe, where my husband lived and developed a property in which we still own, has gone through a tremendous shift. Aspen, any number of communities that were not islands, but similarly, or things that local people treasured, and now those people have been more or less marginalized or can't even afford to live. Because, and I think Airbnb has contributed hideously to it. Houses were never a financial, an income asset, you know, for people. And I'm thinking that maybe one of the, if there is a positive out of the pandemic, maybe one of them will be that houses as investment vehicles may be suppressed because
Or at least more constrained.
absolutely. And we have that problem here that it has sucked up affordable housing because people have come in and bought up properties to invest and to rent out. And that means that people who live here have way fewer choices. You can really see it in Seattle. I was amazed when we were there a couple of summers ago. My husband likes to quiz the Uber drivers. And every one of them, and this also happened to me in, where was BoucherCon in Dallas, all of them had actual real jobs, good jobs, and none of them were able to make enough money to afford to live in the city because of the Airbnb has sucked up And the zillionaires, you know, have sucked up everything. And so ordinary people are pushed out. So what you've got on Nantucket now is a lot more money. Lot more money washing around.
Yeah, it's also very much New York hedge fund money, which is a shift away. It used to be more remote than Martha's Vineyard for people to reach. And so it really took some effort to get to Nantucket when I was a little girl. And now, because it's so accessible by private jet, it's become an extension of the Hamptons. And there's a lot of unease among old-time Nantucketers about that kind of monetization of the island. And at the same time, it does sustain a huge sector of the population who are servicing these homes, whether they're landscapers or cleaning services or people producing gourmet organic produce on the island for the incredible restaurants that service these folks. So, you know, it's all very complex. You can't necessarily undermine what is sustaining a whole group of tradespeople and, you know, creatives like chefs. But it's a fascinating tension in the life of a place, particularly when it is bounded by 30 miles of Atlantic from the mainland, because, you know, you mentioned Aspen. I live in Colorado, and so I'm very aware of Aspen. And what's happened to Aspen is that the people who sustain Aspen, the cops, the ski patrol people, the EMTs, the shop owners, cannot live in Aspen. They have to live 20 miles out. Well, if you go 20 miles out from Nantucket, you're in the middle of the ocean. And if you go, you have to go further. You have to go live in Hyannis on the Cape and fly over every day to do your job. And there are people who do that. A lot of seasonal construction workers who cannot afford to live on the island, but fly as a commuter 10 minutes across the water. So it is, it strains life in all kinds of ways. And using Mary Folger as I do, she's a third generation cop on the island and has a tradition of police enforcement in her family, but also is descended from the Folgers, the Folgers being one of the original founding families of Nantucket. And importantly, Abiah Folger was Benjamin Franklin's mother. She was a Nantucketer, of course, a Quaker. She married a Philadelphia Quaker, produced Ben Franklin. Meredith's middle name is Abiah for that reason. So I wanted to root her in that historic cultural tradition. Not only is she part of the service community on Nantucket, but she has deep, deep roots. And so her communities are multiple. She's engaging with tourists and summer folks. And I distinguish between the two because there's a lot of day traffic on Nantucket of just tourism that's brought in by the ferry and leaves by the ferry after dinner. But there's also the summer people who are there from, you know, May to October. So there's multiple communities, and she kind of has a foot in straddling the two that create the most tension, I think, for life on the island. And she's been a marvelous vehicle for me because I've been able to root her as well in her family and her community while exploring her growth as a person. And I've been with her for enough years that it's been fascinating for me to watch.
Well, you've actually been with her for a really long time because this was the series that you began your career as a writer with.
Yes.
And you wrote those, if I remember right, in the early 90s, because mm-hmm. I read them in real time back then. And then they went quiet for quite a long time. You were exploring other things. You wrote the Jane Austen Becoming Jane Austen series as Stephanie Barron, and you've written other historical novels. You've written at least three spy thrillers, maybe five now. There were three, and then you've written a couple more since. And Mary was always kind of, you know, back there, but not explored. What prompted you to bring her forward? Was it, in fact, all these changes on Nantucket that made her more interesting to write about again?
Well, a combination of factors. Publisher asked me if they could bring the books out again because they had lapsed in print and I had the copyrights had reverted to me. And so Soho Crime wanted to reissue the whole series, but they wanted then to have a new book. And this presented a profound problem for me because the books had been written 20 years prior, 25 years prior. And I didn't want to set the next book, the new book that Soho wanted in the past, because the 90s, frankly, is a profoundly uninteresting decade for law enforcement. You know, it was pre-DNA analysis. There was no digital database for crime statistics. You couldn't send an email. You didn't have a cell phone to call for help. And so to write a quasi-contemporary mystery in the 90s, I know Cara Black does it with Aimé Leduc, but that was not what I wanted to do. So I made a deal with Soho and I said, you know, I will do this if you allow me to revise the whole series and go through and bring them all up to the present and fix the details that are jarringly wrong now, like a blackmail letter, which I had in the first novel. I mean, nobody would send a letter now. They'd send a blackmail email or a blackmail text, you know, with an image attached. It would not be. So I wanted to sort of fix the incongruities of the series, but also, yes, there has been so much change on Nantucket that you write a current book, you know, even the police station. So when I started the series, there was not a single woman on the Nantucket force. So Meredith was presented as this fictional character who was a woman on the Nantucket police force because she had family relationships that dictated her choice of career. Now, of course, half the force is female. So that needed to be corrected. The station itself used to be on Water Street, which is right down near the docks. A couple of years ago, they built a brand new fabulous police station out in the middle of the island. You know, so I had to change in the original books the actual path Meredith took to get to work in the morning because it's no longer true. And if you read the books and she's going to the police station on Water Street, it's ridiculous, you know? So those little things had to really be, I felt, fixed, or the series was kind of half dead. So it was a fascinating process to go through. And the latest book, of course, which is the sixth in the series, continues that momentum forward in a sort of a contemporaneous present. I don't ever mention dates or years. I just kind of root the families that I've worked up over time in a continuous progression forward.
And in the book preceding this, you actually brought something based upon some of your own family history into the plot. I thought it was a really amazing plot. We don't have to go into what the family history was, but I thought it was intriguing that you were able to write what you know in an interesting way. I have an author called Jane Stanton Hitchcock that is a Poison Pen Press author. And I'm probably not supposed to say this out loud yet, but she just won the Hammett Prize.
Oh, fantastic.
Which has yet to be publicly announced, so I'm sneaking it in. But
congratulations.
It is in fact her family story. And there's an energy, I think, that comes from writing some of your own personal history into fiction that you can't necessarily achieve by making it all up. And so I felt that your reintroduction book, really gained a lot of momentum from the fact that you had lived through some of those experiences or your family had.
Barbara,
did you find it created more energy?
I just think being older has. I think that's another aspect of revisiting an old series that is incalculable, that as a person who is now 57 years old, as opposed to one who was 30 when I wrote my first Mary Folger novel, I have lived through so much. I have endured tragedy. I have had losses. I have had great joy. And that informs my understanding of Meredith in a way that was impossible for me when I was 30. You know, interestingly, when I was at the CIA as an intelligence analyst, we happened to invite Tony Hillerman to speak to my particular unit on cultural diversity and how you get into the mind of someone who is utterly unlike yourself. And we chose him because, of course, his depth of knowledge of the Navajo culture that he sort of conveyed in his novels suggested that he had that ability. And what was interesting was he actually sat down next to me at lunch, and I was talking to him about this because I was starting to write the Meredith Folger book, my first book, and I was 29. And he looked at me and he said, I would never attempt to write a book at your age, and I don't think I could have. And I think, frankly, you have to have lived a great deal more to have the wisdom for storytelling that has any sort of depth. And of course, that was not something I wanted to hear. But in retrospect, he probably was correct, at least about the textural depth of a novel that, you know, once you have lived longer, you understand more about human existence that you can possibly convey. So it's interesting. But I wanted to, before you go on, please give us the title of Ms. Hitchcock's novel, because you've neglected to do so.
I did. I'm sorry about that. It's called Bluff, and it's a revenge thriller in
Great.
A way that you, it really is a wonderful book.
You can just send me a copy.
I will. I'm really pleased for her because she has such a personal stake,
you know,
having written the book, that it's, I think, a more meaningful. And the company of The Hammett, previous winners are Margaret Atwood, Stephen King, James Lee Burke, Lou Burney last year. So it's a very distinguished and global crime award. So it means a lot.
That's fantastic.
What I wanted to say to you was, I have many times asked authors who have written many books like you, whether they would ever want to go back and rewrite some of their, you know, or any of their early books. And almost 100% of them have flinched at the very thought, no, you know. And yet for you, I think it really was an essential part of going forward to go back and revise these and to love the process instead of being appalled by it.
It was very cathartic because what I discovered is twofold. The joy of pruning something that was excessively overwritten, for example, correcting details, that there's a sort of, I don't know, for a writer, deep comfort in cleaning up prose. And it also brought home to me, secondly, just how much my craft had evolved over 25 years, that you actually do, when you put in that 10,000 hours or perhaps 100,000 hours by this time, acquire expertise that you aren't consciously aware of acquiring, that you can then bring to bear. And to see the disparity between my first novel and my 29th is really exciting for a writer, I think. It should be, because it shows you how you have evolved in your craft. And I don't think that you have opportunities for that kind of comparison, because most of our feedback as writers comes from critics, and that's far too volatile to, you know, provide any benchmark personally. So I think that was deeply satisfying to me as a process. And I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, it also takes time, you know, for every book that you work on, there's a book you're not working on. So,
exactly.
You know, there was a small sacrifice in time in terms of creating something new. Francine has written some of my very favorite books. I think Jack 1939 is just amazing. And I'm a huge fan of the Jane Austen series. So Francine, what are you working on now?
I will be completely frank with you, Barbara. I have not written a word in 3 months. Because I find the COVID pandemic utterly stifling to my creative impulses. I have no attention span. I've had 5 people in my house for 2.5 months. I've had 4 dogs. I have largely spent my time hunting, gathering, and cooking, and dog walking, and needle pointing. That has been extremely zen for me, just to sit and needle point. But prior to the pandemic, I had launched into the 14th Jane Austen novel, which is called Jane and the Year Without a Summer. And it was due. It is late. It will be written, but it is not there yet. Fascinatingly, though, to me, there's a certain serendipity that I think writers are familiar with, where what you are writing unconsciously or unexpectedly mirrors the current mood, and you struggle to figure out why, but it feels serendipitous. So Jane Austen in 1816, which is when this book is set, was experiencing the first signs of the illness that killed her in 1817. And as a result, she and her sister, Cassandra, went to Cheltenham Spa to take a course of waters for about 3 weeks in the spring of 1816, which was the spring when a volcano erupted in Indonesia, casting an ash cloud around the globe that completely altered the climate of the Earth for the next 18 months. And there was horrendous weather that entire summer. Was chilly, it was cold. Famously, Mary Shelley and Percy Bysshe Shelley and Claire Claremont, Mary's sister, and Byron all holed up in a villa on an Italian
Well, in
lake.
Geneva, right.
Yeah. And Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein because it was so wretched outside that everybody sat by the fire telling stories. So this is the summer that I chose to set the book, and it is a period that feels apocalyptic in England. There was actually famine throughout Europe. There was famine in the United States. There were riots as a result, and people were suffering in their health. And so it has been very strange for me, and perhaps a clue as to why it's difficult to write this book and live in it mentally, given the current situation in our country. So it's, I feel like Jane is mirroring a lot of what I've been experiencing these past few months, and I fully expect that to come out in the writing of the book once I can re-engage with it.
You know, when you wrote her book, her Christmas time book, I thought it would be sort of a happy families book, you know. And it turned out to be, so far, up until this one, by far the darkest of the Jane Austen mysteries. And I thought, wow, that was not what I expected from, you know, Jane. I'm trying to
Jane at
remember.
Christmas. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but the thing that you didn't mention that I think was an interesting thing in 1816, it's that finally the 20-year war with France was over. And so there was some political certainty. Other things may have been terrible, but that constant anxiety of will we be invaded and, you know, all that sort of thing had been to some degree put to rest. But unfortunately, as we both know, the fallout from a long war is a lot of hardship. A lot of people who are maimed or ill or whose lives have been destroyed, lots of women who will always be single or widowed, and you know, many bad things. So I
And in
think 18.
England, it was a profound economic depression. So, the economic depression, which had to do with lack of funding of war industries, interestingly enough, by the Crown, that ended, and the returning men who had no professional employment other than being soldiers, tore apart the economy, and banks failed. Jane Austen's brother Henry lost his entire banking enterprise between 1815 and 1816. And couple that then with this dreadful weather that completely suppressed the crops for that year in 1816, and you have just complete economic collapse both in the city and in the countryside, and hardship in the among the rural poor and the gentry and everybody. So it was a mess. It was a horrific year, and it felt like everything convened in 1816, even though, yes, Napoleon was defeated and they were no longer at war with France, and they were in fact probably the leaders de facto in the vacuum of Napoleon of Europe, and that launched the entire 19th century for Great Britain of empire and conquest that of course culminated 100 years later in 1914 and World War I. So it was both the dawn of a huge period of power for Britain, but it was a horrific period in 1815 and 1816 if you were living through it. So, yeah, fascinating time, and in Jane's life, one of turmoil. So it's probably going to be the darkest book, Barbara. At least to Christmas, there was wassail, you know.
Yes. Well, anyway, let me turn over here to see if PK has any questions or comments from an audience that he'd like to bring forward.
None whatsoever, and we just got kicked out of Facebook.
We
So,
just got kicked out of Facebook.
yes.
Well, this is one of those deals where the phone tends to overheat. So the good news is that we're recording this on Zoom, which we can turn into an audio, but occasionally the Facebook just blanks out for whatever reason. But we're fine because you got to write
Probably
to
my
me.
political views, Barbara. I'm sure.
No, not at all. And it's really ironic because I was thinking as you said that my personal favorite, Georgette Herbert, who I think,
Walks on
was,
water. Yeah.
Yes, it does a wonderful job in the same universe that Austen wrote, even though she lived a century later. Mm-hmm. This is a civil contract, and in which, if you recall, yeah. it ends with the victory at Waterloo, providing the fact that Adam, who gambled everything on victory, is now going to be solvent and is now going to be freed from his financial reliance upon his wife and his father-in-law. Yeah. So, you know, it was a real windfall for him.
It's a stock market. It's a stock market gamble on his part. And I hope he got his money out, because 6 months later, it was all different.
All very true. Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, I've really enjoyed it. I'm sorry about that. But Patrick, do you have any idea why the Facebook thing goes? It's the camera, right?
One, it didn't like the fact that I was logged in on my phone and it was logged in on
Oh, so we won't do that again. All right. So there's technical challenges every time we do this. But the good news is that the best part of it went to Facebook, and Rob can edit this and replace the video if he needs to. So we'll be fine. I'm so glad we got to talk.
I am too, Barbara, but I'm so sorry I didn't get to hug you in person. And yeah. thank you so much for spending your time with me, because you know I miss seeing you in Phoenix.
Well, we missed you too. I would much prefer that you had come down here, but as it turned out, because of the protests, you would have arrived in the riot. And nobody could have come to the store anyway, because downtown Scottsdale is completely blockaded. We had to drive miles around it to get to Rob's birthday dinner last night. Wow. So if you had come, it wouldn't have worked out at all. So
right.
Maybe. So well, let's look, you know, forward towards a personal encounter.
Absolutely. We will. Can.
We've opened the store on a very limited basis, and people are so happy to be here. We're going to actually do a live event with Linda Castillo on July 6th. She's determined to come.
Excellent.
And we probably can't get more than 12 people, you know, maybe a maximum of 15 to sit distance right. apart. But right. I think it will be interesting to see how comfortable that is for us and how comfortable it will be for fans. And that might be sort of a barometer of whether we should encourage people who don't mind traveling, you know, to actually come
yes.
or not.
Yes, yes.
So publishers, as far as I can work out, have basically canceled fall in terms of, you know, doing stuff. But that doesn't mean we have to, you know.
Right.
So we can always figure something out. Or we can do a group thing. I'm doing a lot of little book chats, which are a lot of fun with authors I wouldn't normally be talking to at this time of year.
Right.
You know, which has been great. And we can get like two or three of us together. We could have a Jane Austen conversation, for example.
Okay.
You know, it doesn't have to have any remuneration attached to it. You know, it could just be for fun.
We need Dana.
We do need Dana. We absolutely do. I was just thinking that. And I haven't talked to Natalie Jenner, the woman who's written the Jane Austen Society or whatever. But yeah. I thought that was an interesting book.
Yeah.
I've been to Chawton and all the rest of it. And, you know, I thought her male lead was kind of.
This is not going to go public, right?
No.
Okay. What I'm saying now?
No. Wait, stop. I'll hit not record. Okay. Stop a minute. Where is it? Stop recording. I can do that. What were we talking? Hello again. We were kicked off Facebook for reasons not totally clear to us. So instead of giving you a jerky ending after our discussion about Mary Shelley and how the world was so peculiar in 1816 and so dark and terrible, it led to Frankenstein. And in Francine's case, is probably going to influence her new Jane Austen book that she's working on. We thought we'd at least sign off with grace. So Francine. Back on Facebook, anything you'd like to say to your fans before we move away?
Oh, just that I hope armchair travel through good books is sustaining in the current time and a refuge, both mentally and emotionally, from everything that strains us. And I appreciate all of you for tuning in and reading my work to the degree that you do, or anyone's work, anyone's creative work right now is a gift. And so is Barbara and those who sell the sorts of stories that we write. And I'm grateful for the whole community of readers.
I think that's lovely. And I had an email from Laurie King, who will be coming on here shortly, and we'll be doing a different talk about how she feels about writing a book and basically what's the 1920s bubble between the wars. And whether, you know, in good conscience, this is the time to be you know, talking about it and publishing it. But I have said to her that I think what we need the most at the moment is relief. I think we can't, the barrage of news and bad news and, you know, unexpected events and complications is so heavy that we need a respite. And one really wonderful way to achieve it is to go back and read something, either Jane Russell, or even, you know, Nantucket in what I now call Before with a capital B. it gives our psyches a chance to
take a deep breath.
Yeah, if not heal, at least recall that in 1816, it did move on, and soon there was 1820 and 1830. And the hardest thing about all this is living through it.
It is,
you know, when you get to the other side, it's a whole different issue. But when you're living in it, and all of these uncertainties are just too upsetting. So yeah. I'm grateful for your work, and I'm looking forward, even if it's the darkest Jane ever, instead of the Christmas Jane, which currently is the darkest Jane ever, I will be excited about it. So is there anything that anyone would like to ask on Facebook now that we're back?
We had just a lot of compliments on Francine and her writing. Everybody loved it.
Okay, everybody loved you. Everybody had compliments. We apologize if your opportunity for lost a question, but you know what? No tech is perfect. So here we are. Anyway, thank you all for joining us. And Francine, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. It's wonderful.
My pleasure, Barbara. And I will see you as soon as I can, I promise.
Okay, bye.
Bye.